This podcast is brought to you by Forvis Mazars, an internationally integrated partnership operating in over 100 countries and territories, including South Africa, delivering audit and assurance, tax, advisory, and consulting services to clients. Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast. I'm looking forward to having some fun here and certainly to learning some stuff as well, because I am by no means a crypto and blockchain expert. But the good news is that we have a crypto and blockchain expert on this podcast. And I really do mean expert, because Vihan Olivier is the partner and head of fintech, digital assets and private equity at Forvis Mazars. That very long and exciting title these days can be summarized as doctor. So well done, Dr. Vihan Olivier. You have gotten your doctorate and you did it on auditing cryptocurrency, which I think is really interesting. What an unusual Venn diagram. It sometimes feels like a lot of the people involved in the crypto space also want to be as far away from an audit as humanly possible. And a big part of your passion is in bringing those worlds together, which of course is a big part of blockchain adoption. So welcome to the show. Thank you as ever for doing this with me. And I've got to say, I'm really looking forward to digging in here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really exciting. I think we've spoken in the past about fintech and private equity. So venturing into blockchain-based digital assets, transitioning to the next conversation, I'm assuming.
Yeah, the nice thing is your role, it really does what it says on the tin. You know, we can basically go step by step and just tick off each section. So you're going to have to add some stuff so we can do some more of these next year. Let's focus on the digital asset side, which is obviously crypto, blockchain, the whole story. I think before we dig into all of that, I'm keen to understand more about this research you did recently, which is really interesting. How you actually ended up in this space, and then how that ties into the offering at Forvis Mazars. Because as I said, and I really meant it, auditing and crypto almost feels like an oxymoron, but of course it can't be if people are going to trust this stuff. So give us the lay of the land in terms of the academic journey and what you're up to at Forvis Mazars in this space.
Sure. I started my journey with Forvis Mazars back then in 2010. It was known as, I think, Mazars. Moores Rowland dropped the name to Mazars, but started articles there back at Mazars in Cape Town. Subsequent to that, did my articles, resigned for 6 months, worked a little bit in private equity and real estate. 6 months later, decided to go back to audit, which was quite surprising for a lot of people because a lot of people tried to get out of audit as quick as possible. Building basically my portfolio, eventually made partner in 2018. But just prior to that, I think back in 2017, I started to look at blockchain-based digital assets because it was still quite niche at that point, but did have a little bit of interest in the asset class itself. And then once you become partner, everything gets pushed across your desk. All the cold calls, all the cold emails, and then effectively one of a crypto asset service provider in South Africa actually came across my desk. I went to see them and I came back and I said to my head of audit and my managing partner at that point, there's real opportunity for us to get involved in the digital asset sector because my anticipation is that it is going to get really, really big and I can see this integrating and see more, if I'm calling it, speculative exposure to the asset class. And I wasn't far from wrong, of course. Unfortunately, I hadn't put all of my life savings and retirement savings into cryptocurrency. Otherwise, probably wouldn't having this podcast now. But from there, started to build a practice, started to onboard crypto asset service provider clients, keeping an eye on the industry. And as that started to progress on a global basis as well, got a little bit of exposure. So we first gained a lot of exposure in South Africa and then on a global basis when the other firms, because Forvis Mazars, of course, is in more than 100 countries and jurisdictions. And then when these opportunities did pop up, they started reaching out. So effectively, I became like the subject matter expert on digital assets and spent a hell of a lot of time on the internet researching, looking at the technology and playing around with it to truly understand where we can get that crossroad into the audit profession and digital assets. Now, subsequent to that, also did a master's in blockchain and digital currencies to University of Nicosia. And then, of course, my role developed into the head of digital assets at that point, because we had a nice chunky size portfolio. Then at the end of 2022, FTX happened and the whole cryptocurrency market came crashing down. Everyone was scared, didn't want to be in the sector anymore, didn't want to gain exposure to it. And we basically stayed put at that day. So we were still servicing some of the clients that we had built up during that period. And then from that perspective, we also pivoted into fintech. So that's where the role came from fintech and digital assets. And then while we waited for the market to mature, I also thought myself, well, I've come this far. I've ran the 4 kilometer race, miles. Well, just run the 5 kilometers and do a PhD. So spoke to a couple of universities, had already an idea of exactly what I wanted to do because I'm no academic whatsoever. I wanted to create a practical solution auditors can actually use on a day-to-day basis when engaging with the asset class, and effectively then completed my PhD on the subject matter of designing a framework whereby financial auditors can gain assurance over blockchain-based digital assets. And then leading up to the point where we effectively sit now, I've got a new role as well, which is the global digital asset co-leader for Forbes Mazars. So basically overseeing the global strategy and of the practice on a global front, overseeing all the countries and jurisdictions around the world. So that's it basically in a nutshell in terms of where we got to where we are now. In terms of the work that we do a lot of assurance work for crypto asset service providers, both locally and abroad. We've serviced, I think, 3 of the top 10 cryptocurrency exchanges on a global basis. We still service various crypto asset service providers in South Africa, both from a statutory and a regulatory perspective. Abroad, we service private and publicly listed entities that has exposure to the asset class. And of course, as I mentioned, I was fortunate enough to be utilized as a subject matter expert on most of these engagements, include the US, UK, Singapore, UAE, Switzerland, Germany, Sweden, Hong Kong, all of the countries around the world. And then what I've also been involved with more from an advisory perspective is support to multi-jurisdictional banks in the EU, specifically in relation to blockchain architecture. We've worked with regulators on due diligences on crypto asset service providers. We've also currently working with regulated stablecoin issuers in Europe, performing internal audit. We've done a hell of a lot of tax work, VDPs, tax structures, general advice. And to a certain extent, more so, and we'll touch on it today as well, is custody aspects and gap analysis around custody. And we'll talk about the various different aspects of custody. And then more recently as well, we got appointed as the auditors for Africa Bitcoin Corporation as well, previously Altvest Capital. So involved in that space. And then quite interestingly enough, I think one of the areas that is more interesting to me is the legal aspect of it. I've been fortunate enough to be involved in multiple court cases as a subject matter expert on exchange control regulations, Ponzi schemes, fraud investigations. But I think I was fortunate in the sense that the nature of Forbes Mazars and where we've evolved from, call it a smaller all the way to a challenger to your firm now, is you got exposure to a variety of sectors. And of course, exposure to digital assets and the variety of sectors actually gels well to position us in a very unique situation that we're able to service a variety of clients in various sectors when they've got exposure to blockchain-based digital assets and providing very unique and bespoke types of services that they might need.
It's a pretty interesting career path, isn't it? There's a lesson in there around, number one, you just cannot predict what you will be doing in 5 years from now. I don't think anyone can. And number two, it's the combination of skills. I mean, I talk about this a lot. The finance ghost exists today because of a Tim Ferriss interview of Scott Adams, who did the Dilbert cartoon. And I read about it in, I think it was in Tools of Titans. And basically the principle was, you don't have to be the best at one thing. You got to figure out what you're the best at across combination of skills. And in your case, it's audits and crypto, which is unique. And so you've managed to turn that into something so interesting. I think it's fantastic. And to be able to provide that service into the entire global network of Forbes Mazars, there's clearly a lot of expertise here. So to listeners in South Africa or anywhere really, if you're looking for some proper support here from a financial perspective, assurance perspective, consulting perspective, Vian is a good man to talk to. And by the way, Vian, before we get into some more of these topics, I did laugh at you saying you'd run the 4 kilometers. And you were like, oh, I'll just do the 5 kilometers and make it a PhD. A PhD is not one incremental kilometer unless it's like into the southeaster with a Cape Cobra maybe hissing at you basically on a beach somewhere. That's maybe a 1 kilometer PhD. So well done, nonetheless. I think it's very cool. So now let's, I think, dig into some of the really interesting stuff that I want to learn from you today. So I think when people talk about blockchain, inevitably their minds still go to Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin is just synonymous with blockchain and the other way around. It's just the way it's always been. Is that right? First question. And do you think there's been enough development in blockchain thus far, not necessarily what's still to come, but certainly up until now, that this world really has gone well beyond Bitcoin? Are people starting to distinguish between these two topics?
That's a very valid question. To your point, it all started with Bitcoin. I mean, we all know Bitcoin's white paper was released back in 2008 by individual or group of individuals that we only know as Satoshi Nakamoto. And effectively, what it said was it was designed to facilitate peer-to-peer payments over the internet without the need to trust the individual that you're transacting with. And of course, without the need for intermediary. Now, it's not necessarily any new technologies that was created. It was existing technologies that was grouped together, like cryptography, like digital signatures, like consensus mechanism to effectively build what we know today as Bitcoin. Now, I think what's important to note that even though it was designed as a peer-to-peer form of payment, so it was designed for people to actually utilize on a day-to-day basis when executing transactions at a store or paying an individual, it also transitioned into a speculative asset class that we know today. It still upholds that peer-to-peer element of it, but also there's a speculative side of that in general in terms of Bitcoin and most other blockchain-based digital assets, and we'll get to the most other in a while as well. But I think more importantly, it was designed to be money, but to be money, there needs to be three pillars involved. It needs to be a medium of exchange, it needs to be a store of value, and it needs to be a unit of account. Now, store of value, it's proven itself over the last couple of years. You've seen the price of Bitcoin increase dramatically. Medium of exchange, definitely, because you can go down to Pick and Pay and you can actually pay for your groceries in Pick and Pay, and most goods and services in South Africa as well, you can pay in Bitcoin. But unit of account is effectively where that fell short. And we can chat a little bit about stable coins and how that element of the three pillars of money was effectively sold. Now, initially, when people wanted to gain exposure to the asset class, they went to coffee shops and they traded Bitcoin with one another over the internet, and they would pay someone else in cash. Of course, that evolved into online peer-to-peer places, and that evolved into cryptocurrency exchanges or hybrid custodians, as we refer to them. And then effectively, that led to what we know today, where there's a fully regulated environment that you can actually gain exposure to the asset class through regulated vehicles such as spot ETFs, for example. Now, I think all of this moves in terms of what we know today as the fourth industrial revolution and Web 3. Now, Web 1 was, of course, where you can read information on the internet. Web 2 was where you can read and write information on the internet. And Web 3 is effectively where we are now, where you can read, write, and own information on the internet. And I think all of that plays to what we know as the digital economy. So everything is being digitized, from artwork to identity and now even currency. So all of this plays into what is known as blockchain-based digital assets. And I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there's graphs available. If you take the adoption of the internet from the 1990s all the way to 2010, and you look at the trajectory of adoption of the internet by users, and you take that same principles and apply that to blockchain-based digital assets such as cryptocurrency, and you take it from 2010 up until the date, you can see that the trajectory of users utilizing this technology compared to the internet, it's got exactly the same trajectory. And think about where we are today and for every single facet of our lives that we use the internet for. And think about that in the context of digital assets. So 10 years from now, digital assets will be integrated so immensely into every facet of business that we do and perform on a day-to-day basis that we won't even realize that it's there. And that is why I think it's so important for individuals out there, be it in every walk of life or every sector, get an understanding of the asset class to be able to utilize it, but also to understand the benefit, because there are some real benefits in relation to blockchain-based digital assets.
Yeah, I like that you took us all the way back there to Satoshi Nakamoto and this white paper, a little bit like Banksy in the art world. You know, no one knows who Banksy is, in theory at least. He's done a pretty good job of keeping that a secret. Finance Ghost is a poor relation of these things, because mine is really not that much of a secret at all. Banksy and Satoshi, those are the OGs in terms of keeping it under wraps. I wouldn't mind having either of their bank balances. Well, not sure about Banksy. Maybe the name is not a good clue there, but Satoshi certainly has got a few Bitcoin to his or her name or their name, or honestly, who knows? I suppose we may never know. But what we do know is that adoption curve, as you've talked about, that is pretty interesting. And again, we can learn so much from history. It's so important to actually look at what has happened before and then to say, well, what can we apply to what's happening today from what we can observe in history, and what can we learn from that? And speaking of learnings, I think this whole proliferation of stable coins and trying to solve that pillar of money point that you talked to, that just speaks directly to some of the innovation in the space, some of the development and all of that kind of thing. And obviously this leads into some of the more commercial use cases. So I'm going to hand it back to you to take us through maybe just some of those points around, okay, you know, we started with the sort of blockchain world and some IT geeks busy sending this stuff around the world and trying to understand how it works. And it's amazing how technology starts like that. And then suddenly it gets to the point where your Uber driver starts pitching you Bitcoin, as was the case a few years ago, which is usually when you know it's probably time to sell and climb back in later on. There's a lot of technology development that happens underneath all of this. So you touched on stable coins. Let's maybe talk a little bit about that and just some of the other use cases and how things have evolved.
I think it's an extremely interesting topic, and I think it's a very valid question that you're asking. And I love the fact that it's actually a sentence that was written in my PhD where I specifically said that the blockchain-based digital assets have evolved beyond a mere niche type of technology that's being utilized by internet geeks to a multi-trillion US dollar asset class as well. I mean, currently, now that we We've seen a significant drop in the price, but I think it's still under the top 10 asset classes globally as well. Gold, of course, sitting, I think, over $20 trillion, but I think cryptocurrency sitting, I think, just south of about $3 trillion. But in terms of the history, so we know where blockchain technology effectively came from back in 2008, with the first transaction being executed in 2009. But that was the initial development and where we saw blockchain technology actually being utilized and seen as the real technology that might have utility in the long run. Fast forward a couple of years, of course, from 2008, you see the likes of blockchains coming up, such as the Ethereum blockchain, for example. What was interesting as well is that the Ethereum blockchain was a blockchain in the normal sense, but it had a certain functionality that Bitcoin didn't necessarily have. It had what we know as smart contract functionalities as well. So if you're talking about Bitcoin, capital B, you're talking about the blockchain itself. If you're talking about Bitcoin, lowercase b, then you're talking about the native currency. That's what we trade and we hold at the store's value. For Ethereum, that's the Ethereum blockchain. And of course, the native token of the Ethereum blockchain is Ether. That is the cryptocurrency that we sometimes call Ethereum as well, that we effectively trade on the Ethereum blockchain. Now, with smart contract functionality, the Ethereum blockchain allowed for something spectacular. It allowed for individuals and developers to actually create a non-native token on that blockchain. So, of course, Ethereum blockchain has a native token of Ether, but now you're allowed to create a token that is listed on the Ethereum blockchain. You set the rules and the parameters, but it's not linked to the blockchain per se. So now we create a world where we can create all of these alternative coins that we see out there today. But also with that element, of course, came non-fungible tokens. So non-fungible tokens is based on the ERC-721 standard. And of course, these non-native currencies that we see on Ethereum blockchain is what we refer as ERC-20. But first of all, let's chat about NFTs. I've never been the biggest fan of NFTs. You saw pictures of apes being sold.
Yeah, it was the worst for me. It was just a classic example of things that give technology a bad name. That's what that was for me.
There's that meme about a guy, I think I bought this for, let's say, $1,000. I sold it for $20 for more financial advice. Follow me.
Yeah, exactly. The Bored Ape Yacht Club. That's the X vibes. Yeah, I remember.
So, I mean, Jack Dorsey's tweet was sold on auction for millions of dollars. And when it went on secondary auction, it couldn't even be sold for, I think, $1,000 or something like that. That just shows the hype that was created with NFTs. But NFTs wasn't all bad, because I always take this comparison to Lego. So I think we've actually spoken about this in the previous podcast. But if you take Lego, for example, Lego is fun and games as a child. It helps your mind develop in a certain way, but you don't make a living playing with Lego. And to the same extent as well, non-fungible tokens was exactly that. It let people realize that there's some capability of having a digital representation of a real world asset or a digital asset that can be housed on the blockchain and piggyback off of the various intrinsic values that a blockchain effectively offers. Now, of course, that's NFTs in a nutshell. These altcoins are effectively non-native cryptocurrencies listed on a smart contract blockchain, such as the Ethereum blockchain. And that is what we see today in terms of these Trump coins and ape coins and all of these meme coins in circulation. There is a hell of a lot of market manipulation taking place on this, because it's still fairly unregulated. And as far as possible, I believe that people need to stay away from that as well. You need to look at the asset class for long-term purpose and long-term utility. You need to make sure that you're investing into something that actually has intrinsic value, that has utility, as opposed to just being a meme of a cat climbing a tree or whatever the case may be. But so I think that's also important to understand, that you have this world of altcoins as well. And of course, I'm not going to go in the route of central bank digital currencies or CBDCs, because effectively all that is, it's private permission blockchains. It's just a database housed by one individual, and they just call it a blockchain to try and sell something that it isn't. To come back to the two examples. So with these NFTs, it developed our mind in terms of a way of thinking about how blockchain-based digital assets and the technology can be used in other shapes and other formats. That led us today where we are in terms of the tokenization of real-world assets. And we can chat about that in more detail. But effectively, it is where you tokenize a real-world asset, such as a share or whatever the case may be, and list it on the blockchain. I mean, BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, has a tokenized fund called BUIDL. I think that market cap is currently sitting at about $2.3 and $2.8 billion. But that is effectively what we got from NFTs. Likewise, with these altcoins, what we saw is the development of something referred to as stablecoins. And this was so fundamental in terms of where we stand today in digital assets, because we spoke about that three pillars of money. And the one aspect that general cryptocurrencies fell short was that unit of account. So you couldn't price your goods and services in Bitcoin, because the price would be all over the show. So Now what they did is they developed stablecoins. So now it's a non-native ERC token on the Ethereum blockchain that's backed by real world assets being the US dollar. So effectively the likes of Circle and Tether, what they did with their business model, for every dollar they received in their bank account, they issued $1 on the Ethereum blockchain. So it's always backed by $1. So you don't become depegged and you can actually pay for goods and services with these stablecoins. So there's also a lot of risk involved with these stablecoin issuers. But I think the fundamental issue that it solved is that unit of account, because now you've got an asset class that can move over the internet and over the world as freely as cryptocurrency. It's backed by the security, the decentralization aspect of it, but it's not as volatile. And that's why it's being used predominantly today across the world for cross-border payments and remittances. To such an extent, if you look at Visa and MasterCard, at the volume of transactions in the 2024 calendar year, as well as the 2025 calendar year, I mean, stablecoins has overshot Visa and MasterCard put together. I think if you look at the stats of 2024, the total volume of stablecoin transactions globally compared to that of Visa and MasterCard is 7.8% higher than that of Visa and MasterCard. So there is a lot of money flowing across borders and between businesses and customers, individuals, with the utilization of stablecoins. And as I mentioned, there's real benefit to people and the man on the street when they engage with the asset class.
And I would think that the stablecoins world is where so much of the assurance risk comes from, right? Because, I mean, some of these meme coins have got names that are far too PG for this podcast, so I won't mention them. If you know them, you know them. If you don't, you're probably better off. But when you get into like the stablecoins, where you need to trust that there is a dollar sitting behind this thing, or a rand, or whatever the case may be, I mean, that's a big assurance topic, is to make sure that that is the case. And of course, people use the argument, say like, well, fiat currencies are not backed by gold anymore. There's not a set amount of gold in a vault somewhere. But the point is that they aren't as volatile. So then you can price things in rand, etc. You just have to look at what happens in hyperinflationary situations where countries with rapidly depreciating currencies then switch to, oh, we'll just transact in dollars. That's almost them desperate for a stable coin. And you actually have to wonder, well, what could have happened in Zimbabwe, for example, when the dollar collapsed, the Zimbabwean dollar collapsed so severely. I haven't followed all the stories that have happened in Zim since then. It's just one disaster after the next, really. But how would stablecoin crypto have made a difference at that time? It's just really interesting stuff to think about. This is how tech adoption works. And like you said, it's silly stuff like NFTs and buying pictures of apes and crazy stuff. That in and of itself is daft, but it leads to people understanding more about what the tech can be.
No, you're 100% right. And I've spoken to a lot of individuals within Africa as well. Cross-border payments, remittances is where stablecoins are key, but also there's individuals actually earning their salary in their local currency, purchasing US dollar-backed stablecoins because it's so easy, and then they utilize that as a hedge against the devaluation of their local currency. It's a no-brainer. I mean, where you send funds across from South Africa to, let's say, Zambia, you would pay 12% in remittance fees. Now you can get that low as 2%. So there's real opportunity in terms of using the asset class to put back money into the pockets of especially African individuals.
Frontier markets. I love that example, because that is actually such a good real world use case. There doesn't need to be this huge issue in the middle that makes it so difficult and so complicated and so costly. It's like what it costs to buy and sell property. It drives me insane. It's unnecessary. Blockchain doesn't solve that by itself because a big chunk of it is tax. But at the end of the day, if we need to keep a record of who things belong to and at what price, then that's where blockchain becomes interesting. You really have to wonder why the deeds office is not running on the blockchain, whatever the case may be. And maybe it will, maybe it won't. I mean, who knows where we get to with that. But this is the kind of disruption that can come through.
Yeah, it's the talking point across the world that these offices actually need to run on blockchain. So it's there for everyone to see, they can follow, it's immutable, it's transparent. But I think that's the key thing that a lot of people misunderstand about blockchain-based digital asset. Of course, there was a certain period where a lot of illicit trade was facilitated using cryptocurrencies. In hindsight now, if you're able to gather all the data and there's a lot of analytic tools, it's probably the worst thing that you can use in the world because every single transaction can be traced. And because most cryptocurrency exchanges also have KYC requirements as well, you can track every single transaction being executed on the blockchain. So it's actually easy to pick up instances of money laundering and fraud.
So I want to get into the regs just now, but one more question before we do. And I've seen a lot more of this tokenization of real world assets and a lot of that stuff that's going on. Tokenization of financial assets, people debating, you know, should shares trade like this? And there are platform providers in South Africa even doing this kind of stuff. What is the problem that crypto is trying to address when we see stuff like tokenization, you know, should shares rather trade on a blockchain? Is it a cost thing? Is it a systems thing? Is it a security thing? Because critics of crypto will say things like, it's a solution desperately looking for a problem. In other words, if it's not broken, don't fix it. That's kind of the counter argument. So where do you think this stuff is actually genuinely moving things forward? Because I mean, that remittances example is brilliant. It's spot on. It's 100%. I can totally see that. In other places, it's not always obvious what the benefit of blockchain would be.
So I think if I can summarize it in its entirety, it's to cut out friction. And I'll give you an example. So Larry Fink is the CEO of BlackRock. So when he started looking at blockchain technology or Bitcoin as a whole, he thought it was a Ponzi scam. Fast forward a couple of years and they've got one of the largest funds running on the Ethereum blockchain because he saw the benefit of canceling out all of those fees in relation to intermediaries because these transactions can now seamlessly be executed on the Ethereum blockchain. I think in addition to that is the speed whereby the transactions can be executed. So I've spoken to a lot of individuals globally and a lot of my peers and fellow colleagues abroad. And a lot of the time with traditional finance, they speak about T+3. But with the use of blockchain technology, tokenization of assets, stable coins, you can basically be sitting in a situation where you're talking about T+0. And I'm talking about T+0 seconds, where transactions are effectively executed immediately. I think in addition to that as well is, and I'm very curious in terms of how this will play out, because you've got now traditional markets running, let's say from 9 to 4, whatever the case may be. But once you've got a situation where traditional stocks and type of assets are tokenized, put on a blockchain that doesn't close, blockchain runs 24/7, 365 days a year. I always had a partner within the United States. He said the bank of Bitcoin is always open. And I mean, it's exactly that. So now you have these weekend warriors actually trading full-time over the weekend as well, because they're able to get access to the market on traditional stocks as well. So the long and the short of it is canceling out that friction. It's the cost involved and it's the time involved as well. Security, yes, the asset class does provide some element of security that traditional, let's say, databases don't necessarily provide. But with traditional finance as well, they have certain securities and parameters and controls in place to make it secure. So I'm not saying it's more or less secure putting those assets on a blockchain.
Thank you. That's super interesting. And I guess this brings us neatly to the regulation point, because here's the funny thing about regulation. It protects people, but it introduces friction. And too much regulation takes away the whole point of this progress. Actually, you basically regulate it to death, something Europe loves doing. Or you find a happy medium, which I think the Americans tend to get right, not always. I'm not sure where South Africa ranks on that spectrum. I mean, my own experience with some of the regulators and some of the deals that happen out there, I'm worried that we might go too much into regulation land, but I'll let you comment on that because I'm really not speaking from a place of experience there, more a space of fear. In terms of the regulatory environment, South Africa has been doing some stuff. So I think walk us through what's happening here and then maybe just give us context. And this is probably the most important thing. Where would you rank us on the sort of global regulatory scale from under-regulated to over-regulated? Like, where do you think we're going to land?
Yeah, I think you summarized it well and said the regulators have done some stuff because that's exactly what it is. But I think if we look at regulations around blockchain-based digital assets, countries had three options that they can take. They can take a blanket ban, as we see with the likes of China. They can regulate from the get-go, as we saw with the state of New York. Of course, that didn't pan out well because most crypto asset service providers tried to stay away from the state of New York. And then you can take the wait-and-see approach. And that's to a certain extent what South Africa did in trying to regulate the asset class as well. But I think let's take a step back to our old friend, Mirror Trading International, the biggest Ponzi scheme in 2021, if I'm not mistaken, and today's value, $3 billion that was effectively stolen, I think close to 30,000 Bitcoin. But effectively, what was in place at that stage was no regulations. The regulations that were in place was in terms of a Companies Act regulation, and you don't have any monitoring taking place from the registrar of companies, making sure that companies actually are audited and they submit their financial statements. And I think that's where you can see the flaw effectively happen, because Mirror Trading International was incorporated on the 30th of April, 2019. And effectively, they had 10 months until the point that they reached their financial year end. But at that given point in time, they technically speaking should have appointed an auditor. Then they carried on for another 6 months. At that point, they would have required to issue audited financial statements because they were holding assets in a fiduciary capacity, which would have been the 31st of August. But of course, we had no regulator whatsoever in place at that point, looking over crypto asset service providers as we knew it today. And of course, that meant the scheme carried on up until November 2020, where effectively the whole house of cards basically fell in and everything came to light. And I think what's important there as well to note is the fact that there's a lot of people that say regulations isn't the best thing for blockchain-based digital assets. And the asset class was designed designed to operate outside of the constraints of the traditional financial world. And to that extent, they also believe that tax rules don't apply and then it shouldn't be regulated. But if you look at the value of the financial harm being caused to individuals based on that, and that repercussion still is ongoing today with the MTI liquidation case that hasn't been finalized. That's the thing. Stakeholder protection is what regulations are there for and what it needs to achieve. Now, in terms of how that's rolled out, and of course, more importantly, how that's monitored, is definitely a different discussion that we can unpack as well. So the FSCA basically brought out this position paper where they say they're going to classify the asset as a financial asset under the FIRES Act, if I'm not mistaken. So then I was expecting regulations to kick in fairly soon, but a full 12 months went on and no regulations. Eventually, the FSCA rolled around and say they're going to issue this licensing regime for crypto asset service providers where you need to apply for the licenses. Now, interestingly enough as well, a lot of crypto asset service providers in South Africa had applied for the licenses. I think it was in November 2024, and a lot of them had been issued. Up until today's date, there is about 248 licenses and issues the last time I checked. So that's a lot of licenses for crypto asset service providers in South Africa. And if you compare that to the likes of UK, 44 licenses issued, Germany, 9, Hong Kong, 11, Singapore, 33. So the big question that we need to ask here, are we too willing to issue these licenses to crypto asset service providers? Or are we setting ourselves up for failure again? Because my biggest concern is not the issuing of the license. Sure, these crypto asset service providers make sure that they tick all of the boxes when the licensing gets issued and when the inspection is taking place. But what happens afterward? Is there monitoring actually taking place from the regulator's side to make sure that these crypto asset service providers are still acting above reproach as well? So that's one of the fundamental concerns I currently have with the industry as well. But I mean, if you take it from that as well, the monitoring element, and we've spoken to this a lot as well. So is the FSCA expecting auditors registered by the RBA to effectively play that role? Because if you have a Category 2 FSP license that allows you to deal with cryptocurrencies or be a crypto asset service provider, it requires you in terms of the law as well to be audited. Now, who are the auditors of these 248 crypto asset service providers? Do they have the necessary experience and skills to be issuing audit opinions on these crypto asset service providers? And I mean, to my shock and horror, speaking to auditors locally and abroad, some of the procedures that they execute when gaining assurance is far from anything close to what we would deem assurance from an auditing standard point of view. And I always say within the digital asset sector, it's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you don't know you don't know. So you can't be issuing audit opinions if you don't fully understand the industry and the technology. Hence why that was the idea behind the topic of my PhD, to give that framework to the general public, to give back something that can be utilized so we don't have another downfall of an FTX or Ameritrade Trading International that caused reputational harm, not only to the digital asset sector, but also to the auditing profession as well. Also going on to regulations as well, we talk about income tax to a certain extent as well. Income tax has been phenomenal. They've only rolled out one definition, and that's defining cryptocurrency and saying that the normal rules apply. So besides from that, we haven't even seen any authoritative guidance whatsoever from SARS. So to a certain extent, there's a lot of people that still believe that cryptocurrencies isn't a taxable event. Crypto to crypto isn't a taxable event. If I receive Bitcoin from abroad, it's not a taxable event. And that's why we need this authoritative guidance from lawmakers and regulators, such as the Revenue Collection Agencies of South Africa. And I mean, there's this whole debate about whether cryptocurrency is deemed to be capital when it's deemed to be income. Now, a lot of people will go to Section 9C of the Income Tax Act and they say, well, I've held the Bitcoin for 3 years, therefore it's deemed to be capital in nature, but there's no fruit and tree principle. However, within the tax returns, you can define it as capital or income without any authoritative guidance. So it feels a little bit like a trap that they're setting for you as well without that guidance being provided. And then the big elephant in the room that a lot of people are talking about is exchange control regulations. We saw earlier this year the South African Reserve Bank versus Standard Bank on exchange control regulations, specifically in relation to cryptocurrency. The judge summarized it quite well there in terms of him saying this African Reserve Bank had failed to regulate cryptocurrencies because the asset class has been around for a number of years. And I mean, the figures are there if you run the blockchain analytics. There's been millions and billions of rand externalized from South Africa without proper exchange control approval. And it's been facilitated by the way of blockchain-based digital assets. Stoppers could have been put in place. They could have made crypto asset service providers the custodians of making sure that individuals follow the SDA and FIA rules as well. But that hadn't happened, and that summarized it quite well. Of course, that court case is up for appeal. I think that appeal is being heard in January of this year, and then we'll see where it lands. But I think more likely than not, there'll be a change in exchange control regulations. But then, of course, the other elements of things like listed securities, like ETF. So we saw at the beginning of 2024, we saw in the US, there were several Bitcoin spot ETFs listed on the NASDAQ. And it was quite interesting to see as well, within the first 8 months of those Bitcoin spot ETFs that was listed, $17 billion flowed into those ETFs. In comparison, the gold ETF launched in 2003 took about 3 years to reach that same level. So you can see there was a dire need for this asset class in a more regulated environment. Of course, if we look at it from a South African context as well, the JSE in September of this year, they rolled out a position on exactly what these Bitcoin spot ETFs would look like if you hold the assets directly within the fund as opposed to having another instrument invested in or whatever the case may be. So very interesting to see there, but the one focus that they're looking at is the custody element of it as well. And I think that's important for the listeners to understand is custody is where your real risk comes in. So if you use self-custody, that means you hold your private key to your public key, which means like your PIN to your bank account. With custodians, you're exposed to a custodian. So now you rely on a custodian to keep your assets safe. But what we saw with the downfall of FTX, there was custodians that used custodians that used custodians that used custodians. And now, of course, that creates a ripple effect to the market as one of the custodians fail as well. So that's where the real risk lies with blockchain-based digital assets. And you'll hear about hacks and we can chat about smart contract flaws and those types of things. It's not the blockchain that's being hacked. It's effectively that custodian or the mechanism whereby the private key is secured that fails, and that's where hackers put their focus when trying to misappropriate funds. So within the JSE, of course, we will see a lot more Bitcoin spot ETFs by listing at the conferences. It seems like there's a lot on the table in terms of spot ETFs that they want to list in the near future as well. So we'll see what that looks like. But I think lastly is the stablecoin elements of it as well. And this is quite interesting. Stablecoins has been around for a long time, but the regulation hasn't necessarily been around for the long time. You summarize it well in terms of Europe and the regulations, because they always say US innovates, China copies, and Europe regulates. And it was exactly that. This innovative example of stablecoins came from the US. Not short after the Genius Act was rolled out, the Hong Kong stablecoin ordinance was rolled out, and Europe still doesn't know exactly what they do, what they were still trying to figure out how to regulate the asset class as well. So it exactly summarized that well. But I think what was so genius in the Genius Act is the way that it was written to create a demand for the US dollars and also to create demand for treasury bills as well when issuing these US dollar-backed stablecoin. And I think that is the type of innovation that I would love to see from a South African context as well, which we're not seeing. With the budget speech of this year, one of the paragraphs actually included from the tech side of it is that I'm not sure if it is the Intergovernmental FinTech Working Group will issue a position on stablecoins in South Africa and recommendations in terms of how it will be regulated or whatever the case may be. And that is expected in December of this year. So that's expected to roll out next month based on the budget speech as well. So hopefully that's something positive coming out of this year for blockchain-based digital assets South Africa, but we'll see where it lands. But once again, if you look at the Genius Act, rolling back to that, it's got very interesting characteristics. Besides creating that demand for the US dollar and for the treasury bills, it also has a mechanism in there that they call stablecoin attestation report. So now effectively what they need, and of course what you mentioned earlier in the conversation, is how do you know your assets actually there? How do you know that a stablecoin issuer that says your stablecoin is backed by one US dollar or some similar type of asset that actually exists? So now the legislation is written in such a way that these stablecoin issuers are required by law to undergo attestation reports on a monthly or referred to in the Europe context on a regular basis, where they need a third party auditor to come and actually see that the assets actually exist there and how that corresponds with the smart contract that actually issues that stablecoin. And the most interesting part about this, they are not required to report to the regulator alone on this. They are required to report to the general public on this. So it should be made available on their website as well. And we saw this with the Genius Act, with the Hong Kong stablecoin ordinance, and with Lika as well. So that is the true principle of what it means to provide stakeholder protection. Of course, you can do something that's good for the country and good for the fiscal, but you also need to be mindful of that stakeholder protection. And I think that is what the Genius Act did.
Indeed, yeah. Look, it's super interesting in this space. I was reminded while you were chatting and you were talking about mirror trading and all of that, I remembered reading in the press a couple of years ago about Usain Bolt losing a whole lot of money, and I thought it was a crypto scam, so I went and Googled it. My base case is that it was a crypto scam because it so often is, but actually it looks like that was just money that basically disappeared out of his bank account, which is just astonishing. So it just shows you none of these things are perfect. It's just banking is a lot older and has had more time to be regulated and is a lot better, but stuff still happens. And I also went and looked now. Look, I asked Copilot and I asked Google AI and got two different answers. What a massive shock. Vian, look at that. AI giving me two different answers. But there are roughly somewhere between 35 and 40 banking licenses in South Africa. So that's an interesting thing to compare to the number of crypto asset service provider licenses. So that's commercial banks, mutual banks, local branches of international banks, etc. You would certainly expect there to be far fewer banking licenses than crypto asset service provider licenses, but it is interesting to contrast the two. And I guess if you have not enough licenses, then it's too easy for the black market to just carry on. They'll just say, oh, there aren't enough providers, and they'll just do their thing. If you have too many licenses, you're bringing more people into the net, it then becomes harder to justify doing unlicensed stuff, but you've got to monitor it. And that's obviously where the risk is of that falling over. So from a regulatory perspective, it's going to be very interesting. I think the next podcast you and I do, we should actually really dig into the custodianship and all of that stuff so people really understand these concepts, because I think we could dedicate an entire podcast to that. But in the interest of time on this one, I'm going to ask you one more question, which is, over the next 12 months, more or less, and you've hinted at some of the stuff that might be coming, but what are you looking out for, not just in South Africa, but internationally as well, in the world of crypto, blockchain? What do you think some of the big focus areas are? What are you excited to see? What does it mean for you?
Yeah, I think digital assets has taught me one thing. It's definitely humbled me in a lot of circumstances, especially from an investment perspective and how the technology can evolve and how it has evolved over the last couple of years. But it also taught me something fundamental that I carry with me on a day-to-day basis, that 12 months is actually quite a long period. And you think a year from now, it feels like around the corner. But a hell of a lot can happen in 12 months, and specifically so with the digital asset sector and the way the technology moves and the way that individuals innovate to that extent as well. South Africans have been very innovative, even in a global context. I mean, a lot of the virtual asset service providers that I speak to globally as well have some connection to South Africa or are actually South Africans as well. I think there's the way that our brains are wired based on our traditional banking system and solving issues and those sorts of things. But it's really phenomenal to see. But in terms of what the expectation is going forward, first of all, regulations. There is going to be a hell of a lot more regulations. And secondly of that, there needs to be a hell of a lot more regulations, because at the end of the day, we need stakeholder protection. Of course, the asset class provides the element of efficiency for people to utilize in their day-to-day lives or from an investment perspective, but they need to be protected as well to a certain extent. And I think that's what regulations effectively offer. I think real-world assets is probably going to be the fundamental area going forward. We're going to see whether we're going to have a further integration of interoperability between different blockchains, because, of course, we do have an issue of there's thousands of blockchains out in the world, and these blockchains need to start to speak to each other. I like to see a decrease of alternative coins or meme tokens or whatever the case may be, regulations around that, so we can get that out of the market and get that cleaned up. But I think stable coins and real world assets within the traditional financial services world is what's going to be key. I mean, we've had a lot of discussions globally, especially in Europe, with auditors and fund administrators and fund managers to see what the impact of real-world assets and tokenization of real-world assets will effectively look like going forward, what would be the regulations around that, and how users will effectively obtain the benefit. So I want to say 12 months from now, but knowing the way the technology evolves, I'll probably say 0 to 6 months is going to be the focus and where I see a lot of activity happening as well. And of course, from South African context, a lot of regulations, will probably see exchange control regulations being clamped down as well. And I'm hoping the FSCA also cleans up the crypto asset service provider licensing regime a little bit. And God forbid we see any downfalls or similar type of MTI and FTX setups in South Africa. But yeah, that's basically the expectation from my side.
Yeah, and thank you so much. Always so much to learn from you. I'm going to link through to your profile on the Formis Mazars website and to your LinkedIn in the show notes for those who want to reach out. I think you are certainly coming through as one of the genuine experts in the space in South Africa. So to anyone in the industry who wants to understand more about digital assets and some of the regulations around it and how this can be audited and a lot of the professional services around it that have been around the banking industry for so long and desperately need to make their way more into crypto, Vian is certainly a good guy to speak to. Vian, thank you so much for your time on this podcast. It's been really cool. I've learned a lot, and I look forward to doing the next one with you.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate the time and great being on the podcast again.